take it for yourself, though, please.
I'm Ugo Providenti. I have something to do with you. Just would like to say thank you for the support. Thank you so much. I appreciate your support.
Okay.
Very much.
Morning, how are you?
So
2 o'clock tomorrow, right?
2 o'clock. I will be there.
Okay, good. Okay. So last set of reminders. Your project is due by 5 o'clock today. About half the projects are already in. I was looking. So a lot of the projects are coming in, so you have till 5 o'clock to get it in. And please try to send it as a PDF file, not as a collection of files, like 6 files separated. Because odds are that I might not even look at a file if you haven't drawn my attention to it. So pull it all together. The nice thing about a PDF file is you never run into formatting issues when somebody... Microsoft Word files are kind of dicey. PDF files, I can put the comments in, you'll always be able to see them. And if you haven't sent it in already, make sure you CC your entire group when you send your project, because when I reply back to you then with the project, everybody gets it at the same time. So you don't feel like the project hasn't come back to you. The second is your finals. There are 2 final exams, one on Wednesday from 10 to 12 in 260, one on Friday just in this room. There's going to be no second room because enough people are taking the early final that we will not have the kind of rush we get all being in this room. So the Wednesday final is 10 to 12, the Friday final is 1 to 3. Okay? And other than that, one final reminder, you have to get the CFE done. If you don't know what the CFE is, I don't know where you've been for the last year and a half, you know. But the CFE is the thing you need to get done by the end of the class. It opens tomorrow, so I'll send out a reminder with where to go. And it closes on Thursday. To be quite honest, I couldn't care less whether you do. The reason I kind of remind you is if you don't do it, I bear a cost, and here's what the cost is. When you go to check your grade, you won't be able to find your grade. And I know exactly what's going to happen once you hit that brick wall. You're going to email me on Christmas Day saying, I can't find my grade. So please remember to get it done so it's out of the way. So when you go check your grade, it's accessible. So let's get this process started. The way I've structured today's session is half the session, I want to review the whole class. Feels like we've done this immense amount, but as we go through this review, you're going to be surprised at how little we've actually done, how I've actually recycled the same thing 100 different ways to make it look like I'm doing new and different things. So half the class is going to be a review using a series of tests. So think of this as a review for the final exam. It's actually, even if though you haven't reviewed, this is a quick review of basic stuff for the final. The other half is your own feedback to me, the numbers you sent. Oh, and thank you. I think I got out of the 262 people in the class, 236 sent your summaries in. If you haven't sent your summary in, please send it in still, because I'll actually put the entire spreadsheet up online. There are no names attached, so you have no embarrassment to go with the evaluation. So it'll go online with, you know, alphabetically ordered, so you can see what's going on. So let's get this process started. When I started this class, I said there were only 3 ways to value an asset. The first is intrinsic valuation, most often captured through a discounted cash flow valuation, where you estimate expected cash flows. Keyword is expected, a lot of uncertainty. You come up with a risk-adjusted discount rate, you get a present value, and you say that's the value of the asset. So intrinsic valuation. The second is what we call relative valuation, but it's really pricing, where you value something based on how similar things are being priced by the market. Very different philosophically than an intrinsic valuation. And the third, and this is perhaps the only new aspect of valuation that is new and different, it's applying option pricing, not to value options, but to value distressed equities or undeveloped reserves in an oil company or a biotechnology company working its way through. So I'm going to start with intrinsic valuation because, in a sense, it's been the foundation for this class, even when we did relative valuation. Very quick review. There are four inputs, and only 4 inputs, that drive the intrinsic value of a company. First is, what are your cash flows from existing assets? That comes from your financial statement, the 10K, the annual report. And I can estimate those cash flows either before debt payments or after debt payments. Before debt payments, you get free cash flow to the firm. After debt payments, you get free cash flow to equity. So that captures how well I'm managing my existing assets, the cash flow to the firm. The second is the value of growth. Not growth itself, but the value of growth. And the value of growth is a function of both the good things that come from growth, your earnings grow, and the bad thing, which is the reinvestment. The net effect is what drives the value of growth. The third is the risk, which captures is captured in the discount rate. And of course, you have to assume some point in time your firm becomes a mature firm. You discount them all back. You get a present value. The value that you get if you discount free cash flow of the firm is the value of the operating assets. You add cash. You subtract our debt. If you have options, you've got to subtract them out. And if you have holdings in other companies you haven't valued yet, you've got to bring them in. That's a basic framework. We revisit it over and over and over again. So here's how I decided to structure the review. You guys remember Dante's Inferno? This is one of those required readings in college. Dante was this deeply disturbed Italian guy. My wife's Catholic. I go to church more often than most Catholics. He had all these Catholic guilt complexes carried to the nth degree. I mean, what healthy human being sits down and visualizes hell in all its layers? That's what Dante did in Inferno, right? This is the light layer of hell. So I thought I'd use Dante's Inferno to bring home the essence or the kinds of mistakes I see in discounted cash flow evaluation. So here's where we're going to start. We're going to start with the warm layers of hell. And then we're going to go further and further in. So depending on the degree of your DCF sin, I'll drag you deeper and deeper into hell. So let's see if you can get out of this process unburnt. Okay? So I'm going to start off with what I call the base year fixation. You know what the base year fixation is? You get so caught up in the last 10K that you forget that there was time before 2014. There was a 2013 and a 2012. So I'm going to talk about how that can get you into trouble. Very simple concept, light layer of hell. Then we're going to talk about taxes, how we miscount, double count, forget to count taxes. So that's going to be the second layer. The third layer, we're going to talk about growth and how that adds value and how we can get casual about growth. Fourth is we're going to revisit some basics on discount rates. Fifth, we're going to talk about paying for growth, that if you grow, you've got to set aside money, and what happens if you don't do that. The sixth is I'm going to reemphasize something that I've talked about all through this class, but that you might be tempted to forget once you get out there, because most people out there don't let debt ratios change over time. They act like the debt ratio, once it's set, is set forever. So we're going to talk about how debt ratios change and how that will change your cost of capital. Reminder on the terminal value in case you need one. It's not an ATM. You can't keep going to it every time your value gets low. So we're going to, again, review those constraints we put on the terminal value. Then we're going to talk about the garnishing people do after they say they're done. 20% for control, 50. So we're going to talk about those loose ends very quickly. Cash, cross holdings, how to deal with them. And then we're going to talk about going from aggregate value of equity to value per share. There's many a slip between the cup and the lip, right? You just divide by the number of shares, but it's not that simple. If you have options, you have restricted shares, you're voting and non-voting shares, it gets difficult to do. And the final layer of hell I'm going to call the Wasserstein-Perella layer. And if you remember a class way back, session 3, session 4, you're going to see that picture again just to remind you never to do what they did. So let's start this game off with the first layer of hell. So as we go through, I'll remind you where you are in hell. So this is a very slightly warm, might actually be a pleasant part of hell, okay, if there is such a part. Right? So here's my challenge to you. You're valuing ExxonMobil using the financial statements. So this is in early 2009. In fact, this example can be written with 2014 and 2015 numbers. The same things kick in. So you're valuing ExxonMobil in 2009, the most recent financial year is 2008, and here's what you see. Revenues of $477 billion, after-tax operating income of $58 billion, net capex of $3 billion, change in working capital of $1 billion, free cash flow of the firm of $54 billion. Assume I've done those right, so I pulled those right out of the financials. The free cash flow to the firm in the most recent year was $54 billion. Let's assume the cost of capital for ExxonMobil is 8%. And you've used a conservative, stable growth rate, 2%. So you follow the rules on growth. It's less than the risk-free rate. Very quickly, with that free cash flow to the firm, cost of capital, and growth rate, what's the value of my operating assets at ExxonMobil? If I just take last year's cash flow, $54 billion, forget about the 1 plus G. $54 billion divided by 0.08 minus 0.02 is 0.06. 54 divided by 0.06 is $900 billion. Either ExxonMobil is the greatest bargain on the face of the earth, or I've screwed up big time in one of my numbers. I've used only three numbers. The free cash flow to the firm last year, the cost of capital, and the growth rate. Which of those three numbers is the culprit here, do you think? Because clearly I've screwed up. It can't be that undervalued. What do you think is the culprit in my bad valuation? The free cash, but I got it right. I can show you the numbers. I could, you know, it's exactly what it was in 2008. But what is it about the free cash flow of the firm that's misleading me? Okay, so I'm going to give you a chance to ask me the question that's going to isolate my problem. What's the question you need to ask? What was the oil price during 2008? What is it now? That's it. The oil price during 2008 was $70 a barrel. The oil price at the time I did this valuation was $45 a barrel. What does that tell you? Even though that free cash flow to the firm is right for 2008, it no longer is okay because you've now moved to a $45 cash oil price. So what do I need to do? Easier said than done, I need to normalize the earnings. I need to figure out what ExxonMobil's earnings would be at $45 a barrel. If you're valuing an oil company today, you know what the oil price hit today, this morning? It's down to $35 a barrel. The average oil price last year was $55 to $60 a barrel, which was down from $75 a barrel 2 years ago. With oil companies, the trailing numbers have become almost completely useless from a valuation perspective, because if you use them, every oil company is going to be the bargain on the face of the earth. So you need to normalize. Easier said than done, but to go back and review the notes, we talked about how to clean up, how to correct earnings for different oil prices. But that's the base of fixation. Let's move on. This is a mechanical question, and hopefully everybody here will get it right. Let's assume that I give you the financials for a company. EBIT, interest expense, taxable income, taxes, net income. So there's a company with $48 million in free. And just in case you've forgotten the free cash flow to the firm, which you shouldn't have, but just in case, I've actually written it out on the side. Let's assume I told you that this is a firm with zero growth in perpetuity. Its cash flows are going to be constant forever. And I asked you to estimate the free cash flow to the firm, for this firm. First, let's start off at the top. What are you going to use as your after-tax operating income? Operating income is $100 million, right, EBIT? What should I subtract from that to get to my after-tax operating income? This is a very simple mechanical question. We've gone over it in class, but I want to make sure we get it right. Why can't I just subtract the taxes paid? Can I subtract the $32 million? 100 minus 32 is 68. Why not? What's wrong with subtracting actual taxes paid? If I do that, I'm going to end up at $68 million, right? If I use $68 million, what's the sin I've committed? Remember, we're talking about sins here and hell. Might as well isolate the sin. What have I done? I've counted the tax savings from interest expenses. Remember the $20 million interest? $8 million I got in tax savings. You're saying, so what? It is a tax saving. So what? Why shouldn't I count the tax savings from interest expenses? I'll be double counting. Where? Because when I discount this $68 million at the cost of capital, embedded in the cost of capital is an after-tax cost of debt. That effectively will mean tax savings get double counted. I know we've repeated this multiple times, but I just want to make sure I reinforce it. When we talk about EBIT times 1 minus T, that line item we almost automatically start this thing with, you just plug and chug, we're talking about a hypothetical tax. We're talking about the tax you would have paid if you'd paid taxes on the $100 million. You don't. We know the tax rate is 40%. How do we know that? 32 divided by 80, right? Is 40%. I'm going to take the 40% tax rate and apply it to the $100 million. I'm going to end up with $60 million. But remember that argument, because you are going to see people double count. And I want you to remember why you don't subtract out actual taxes paid, because that is double counting that tax benefit. So I got my after-tax operating income. I'm in trouble now, right? Because to get to free cash flow to the firm, what else do I need? I need CapEx and working capital. I haven't given you that. But I think you can solve for the free cash flow to the firm in this specific case without knowing the CapEx and the working capital. Why? What have I told you about the company's growth? It's zero growth. If you have zero growth, how much do you need to reinvest? Zero reinvestment. So your depreciation and CapEx are offsetting each other. Net CapEx will be zero. Working capital change will be zero. Your free cash flow to the firm will be equal to your after-tax operating income, which is $60 million. It works only because you have no growth. The minute I introduce growth, the whole process has to get redone, because then I have to ask, how much are you reinvesting? The fact that I'm not growing is what allows me to do this. Any questions? Now, let's revisit another question that each of you had to deal with when you did your discounted cash flow valuation, which is, you have a firm, and you have to estimate growth, and it's a high-growth firm. Question is, how long do you think high growth will continue at your firm? So think about your firm. Don't make it abstract. Think about the company you value and say, how long will growth last? About 75% of you valued high growth companies. There's a reason for that. Who wants to value another boring non-growth company? So you valued high growth companies, and this is a question you face, 50% growth, but for how long? And of course, you're saying, well, it's a young company, lots of potential. So the question here is a mechanical question. How long do you want this growth to continue? Less than 5 years, 5 years, 10 years, or more than 10 years? And I've kind of given away what you should be thinking about, which is that for companies to grow for long periods, you're talking about the exception rather than the rule. This is a graph we saw very early in the class, where I looked at IPOs right after they go public and compared their revenue growth rates to the growth rates of the sector they were in. 1 year after the IPO, these companies grow 15% faster in the sector. You're saying, that's why I bought the company. 2 years after, they grow 7% faster. By the time you get to 5 years after your IPO, you can't tell the company apart from the sector. Growth doesn't last very long at the typical growth company. In fact, the median growth period for a high growth company is about 4 to 5 years. So when those of you got to 10 years, looked at the 10 years and said, but I'm running such a high growth company, why shouldn't I go to 20 or 25? Remind yourself, at 10 years, you're already at the 95th percentile of growth periods of growth companies. Let me ask you a question, to which the answer is obvious. Are there companies that have grown for longer than 10 years? Absolutely. We can name them, right? It's the Microsoft, the Google, the IBMs. And what is the fact that we can name them tell you about these companies? They are the exception rather than the rule. You never value a company to be an exception right off the top, because then what do you have as your upside? So that's why I always stop my valuations at 10 years. And you will see people pushing me. I say, why can't we go 25 years? This is such a promising company. Remind them of that basic statistic. Most companies grow 3, 4, 5 years. And even at 10 years, you're pushing the envelope in terms of how long growth can last. So now let's do some very specific mechanics. This is a cost of capital computation I have here. I'll make a confession. I've made at least 7 mistakes in this one cost of capital computation. And as I go through, I'd like you to start checking off the mistakes, okay? So by now, you'll get a sense of which mistakes I've made. So my job is to estimate the cost of capital for a technology firm. It's a U.S.-based company, but it gets 20% of its revenues from Brazil. File that away for the moment, but it's a U.S.-based company. So I try to compute the cost of capital. Here's how I've done it. And as I go through it, your job is to tell me, is to at least for the moment, to think about what I might be messing up on. The first thing I did was I needed a risk-free rate. It's a U.S. company. I decided to do things in U.S. dollars. I checked the T-bond rate. It's at 2.2%. And I said, you know what? This looks low. Too low. So I've normalized the risk-free rate. I pushed it up to a normalized. I took an average over 25 years. So that's my risk-free rate. So if you think that's a mistake, just on your page, just put an X next to it. That's if that's something I shouldn't have done. Then I needed a beta. I went to my trusted Bloomberg terminal. I typed in the name of the company. A beta page popped up. I was careful. I used the adjusted beta from Bloomberg, 1.20. I needed an equity risk premium, and the only way I knew how to estimate equity risk premiums was from history, so I went to a data service, in this case Ibbotson, and they told me that the historical risk premium from 1926 to 2008 was 5%. So I used that as my risk premium. And while I was there, I also checked out another premium that they'd estimated, which is small companies earn 3% more than large companies through in a small cap premium. So my cost of equity is my normalized risk-free rate plus my adjusted Bloomberg beta times a historical risk premium plus a small cap premium. That was my cost of equity. To get to the cost of debt, I actually could not find a rating or bonds because this company had bank loans. So here's what I did. I took the interest expense at the company and divided by the book value of debt. It's called a book interest rate. Gave me 3%. I use that as my cost of debt. Now, to complete the process, I need weights, right? For equity, I did use market value of equity, just as I was taught in class. But for debt, remember, I only bank loans, so I'm kind of lost. So I go through the balance sheet. And I remember from my accounting class, my accounting professor saying, be conservative, count everything in as debt if you're worried. So I counted everything in, accounts payable, supplier credits, all in there. So I've got $1 billion in liabilities, not even debt. I've counted that as debt. And for my after-tax cost of debt, I use the effective tax rate. Yeah, because that's the number that was in the 10K. As I said, I've made so many mistakes in this one computation, I don't even know where to start. Let's start with the first one. What's the first mistake I made? It's right at the beginning. I normalize the risk-free rate. So let's hear your argument, because you will have to use this in about 7 or 8 months once you start on the job, because there will be people who normalize around you. What's wrong with normalizing risk-free rates? Oh, you lost the argument. Okay, they're going to normalize risk-free rates on you. If you say, what's wrong? You say, oh, I don't know, it just doesn't sound right. What's wrong with normalizing risk-free rates? Come on, you have the ammunition. Yeah.
You can't really find this type of risk-free rate in the current.
The first is the risk-free rate is not an abstraction, right? It's what you're going to invest in if you don't invest in this stock. And if you don't invest in this stock, the question you've got to ask this guy who's using the normalized risk-free rate is, show me the 5% and I'll use it, because if I can't invest at 5%, I can't make up an opportunity cost. So first, this isn't like margins or revenue growth where you can normalize. This is an actual opportunity cost. I can't find it. Second, is normalization a kind of objective process? What does normalization require? That you go back over a period of time. How long? You get to pick. Do you see why that's going to matter? A 10-year average is going to be very different than a 25-year average. So don't tell me normalization is somehow objective. It reflects how old you are as an analyst, probably, and what you want to show as a risk-free rate. So mistake number one, the risk-free rate should never have been normalized. Let's move to the beta. I used an adjusted beta from Bloomberg. Remind me again what it's adjusted for? Absolutely nothing. It's just a beta move towards one. So it's a regression beta dressed up to move towards one. So I've basically used a regression beta. What's wrong with regression betas? As I said, we're preparing your arguments for the times you're going to face up to people using these on you. What's wrong with using regression betas in valuation? I can think of at least three things. Let's see if you can get at least two of the three. No, it's just based on returns. Returns reflect everything that's going on. So that can't be the reason, right? If you're looking at returns, you're saying the Bloomberg beta might not. But we don't even have to get that specific. In general, what's the problem with the regression betas?
It's only against the
I'm sorry?
It's only against the
market. You want only? No, that's actually a good thing. You want it only against the market risk. That's why we use betas. So it's not an argument about using betas itself, but what's wrong with regression betas? It's very noisy. What does that mean? That's a word I use all the time. And I'm casual about using it. But there'll be people say, what do you mean noisy? It doesn't make any noise. Look, it's just silent right here. What is it? What are we talking about?
I mean, specific things that change this.
Which number in the Bloomberg beta page are you going to point them towards?
Standard error.
That's it, right? You don't even have to talk about noise. Say, look, you think it's a fact. Look at that standard error. They say, what's a standard error? Then you can coach them on statistics 101. So it's noisy. What else? Backward looking. Saying, so what? Well, I want a beta for HP today. If I gave you a beta for the last 5 years for HP, it's not going to help you because it's now splitting up as two separate companies. It's backward looking. And third, if your debt to equity ratio is changing over time, and you know it is for most companies, then using a regression beta will reflect the average debt to equity you had over the last 5 or 10 years, not the beta today. Try looking at Glencore's beta. It's not going to reflect its debt to equity ratio today. So I should not have used the adjusted beta. So that's the second mistake. Let's talk about equity risk premiums. What did I do? I look backwards. Same two critiques of the beta kick in, right? It's noisy. Noisy in what sense? It has a standard error of about 2.3%. Remember that. With 86 years of data, which is what most people use right now, you have a standard error of about 2.3%. And the small cap premium is more mythology than fact. If you look at the small cap premium, it's true there's a premium going back to 1926. Since 1981, there has been no small cap premium in the U.S. For the last 35 years, there has been no small cap premium. So I've blown up the risk free rate, I've blown up the beta, I've blown up the risk premium, right? We'll talk about what to replace them with. Let's move down. I could not find a cost of debt because my company had no bonds and no rating. So I used a book interest rate. What's wrong with using a book interest rate? It's not the current rate, but it's a rate I've locked in, so why not use it? It's a rate on which I, so it's the debt I have on my books. It cost me only 3%. Well, I'm not planning to. You're right, but that's an argument that's not going to win you the argument because you bring in marginal and abstract. I don't care. This is a valuation. What are we trying to do in a discounted cash flow valuation? Saying if you raise money today to buy the company, that's really what would it cost you, right? And if you raise money today, you're not going to be able to raise money at 3%, especially, in fact, in this cost of capital. This analyst has made a fatal flaw, which is the risk-free rate he's used is 5%, and he's telling you the pre-tax cost of debt is 3%. You don't even need any fancy arguments. How the hell do you borrow at 2% below what you called your risk-free rate? So you say, how else am I going to get the cost of debt? So fill in the rest. What should I do to get the cost of debt if I can't find a rating or a bond? You got to be your own rating agency. You don't have to use the interest coverage ratio, but you got to make your own judgment on what can this company borrow money at long term today. So that 3% cost of debt has to be replaced with something more sensible. Oh, by the way, in the equity risk premium, we'll come back and talk about this 20% from Brazil stuff. Because this analyst has used the U.S. premium because it's a U.S. company, and obviously you're not capturing the country risk in the company. What about the tax rate? I use the effective tax rate. Why should I use the marginal tax rate? Again, convince me as to why the marginal, for cost of debt at least, why the marginal tax rate has to be used. What am I measuring there? The tax benefits from interest expenses, right? So work me through the process. How do interest expenses save me tax? I have $1 million in income. I have $100,000 in interest expenses. I subtract the $100,000 from the million. I report $900,000 in taxable income. Think of where I saved on taxes. Well, the last $100,000, not the first or the middle. So if I'm doing the cost of capital for Apple, I don't care that the effective tax rate for Apple is only 15%. I'm going to use a 40% marginal tax rate because that's where Apple's getting the tax savings from the interest expenses on its $50 billion in debt in the U.S. against U.S. income on which it would have paid 40%. So I should have used the marginal tax rate. Final question. What should the weights be in the cost of capital? Market value of equity, that half is right. And when we talked about debt for the cost of capital, and we did this just very recently, what should be in that debt? Not accounts payable, supplier credit, not everything, but only interest-bearing debt and lease commitments if you have them. You're saying, but I want to be conservative. I am being conservative because if I let you count all that other stuff, your debt ratio is going to balloon out, your cost of capital is going to come down. So here's what I did. I replaced each of the numbers. I started off by replacing the corrected, the adjusted, normalized risk-free rate with the actual. I replaced the Bloomberg beta with the sector average beta adjusted for the debt to equity. I replaced the historical premium with an implied equity risk premium. And I broadened the fact that there was a Brazilian country risk exposure to push up the cost of equity. For the cost of debt, I replaced the 3% that was used with a synthetic rating and a cost of debt of 9%. This is a very risky company based on its interest coverage ratio. I used the marginal tax rate. I replaced these debt ratios with market value debt and equity. The cost of capital I end up with is 12.6%, not the 8.05%. But if you get a chance, review this because, in a sense, we've hit every point that we talked about in the context of discount rates. It took us like six sessions to do. Now, I told you, we buffer sessions a lot in MBA programs. It's an example of that. We could have done it in 10. So that's basically it, cost of capital of 12.6%. Any questions? Let's talk about growth. A lot of valuations are based on management forecasts. So you go to the management and say, give me a forecast of cash flows. I'm going to play the role of management, and you play the role of a canny valuation analyst. In other words, I'm going to show you my forecasts, and rather than challenge me frontally on my revenue growth rate, which where you lose, the reason you lose is I'm going to say, I'm the manager. I know what I'm doing. I want you to look at my forecast and ask me questions which will tell you whether my forecasts are internally consistent. What does that mean? Whether I'm making assumptions that make sense with each other. So I'm using a 10% growth rate. I'm letting revenues grow at 10% a year. I'm keeping the margin fixed. The after-tax margin is 30%, so the after-tax operating income also grows each year. I add depreciation, subtract capex, subtract change in working capital. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do, right? I have free cash flows of the firm. So do these cash flows make sense? What's the question you need to ask me to figure out whether my forecast actually makes sense? Yeah.
What are
the total sales in the sector? Okay, so let's assume it's $10 billion, so the growth is sustainable. That's a good question to start with, right? Am I getting my market share to a point that I cannot sustain? If I'd used an 80 or a 90% revenue growth rate, that's a scary potential outcome. So let's suppose you put that to rest. What else? You can ask about my margin. Is the margin a sustainable margin? Are you the 30%? So I could show you the industry average. So let's say I've checked that off. So revenue growth looks okay. Margins look okay. Am I home free?
Can you go with the capex you're investing?
In fact, if you ask me that question, you know exactly what I'm going to say, right? Of course. So ask me a more specific question about whether I'm reinvesting enough to grow. You know what the net capex is. It's actually a constant every year. What's my reinvestment each year? It's actually not zero. It's 20% of my after-tax operating income. Just add up the net capex plus change in working capital. It's 20% of my after-tax operating income every year. I'll give you a clue. What's my growth rate? 10%. And I'm reinvesting 20% each year. You know what the question you should ask me is? What was my return on capital last year? And I don't even know why you're asking this question, so I let it slip. I made a 12% return on capital last year. You got me nailed. Do you see why? Because what am I implicitly assuming my return on capital will be in the future? To get a 10% growth rate with a 20% reinvestment rate, work out the algebra. My return on capital has to be 50% on my new investments. And what did I tell you about my return on capital last year? It was 12%, 10%. So the question you need to ask, so this way, you don't even have to confront me on my own bad assumption, because in a sense, I am making this jump in return on capital, and the reason I'm making it is I never even thought through it. I just took last year's reinvestment and grew it at the same rate as everything else. So when you look at cash flows, that's what you want to focus on. What's being reinvested? What's the growth rate? What's the imputed return on capital? So let's say you're valuing a company, in this case, Hormel Foods. You've got 90%, it's a company with about 10% debt, 90% equity. This is where its existing cost of capital is, 6.8%. You believe, and don't ask me where this came from, that the target debt ratio for Hormel Foods is 30%. Lots of valuations, you'd see a target debt ratio kind of floating around. When you value Hormel Foods, you need, if you want a cost of capital, the target debt ratio, how would you get it? What can you not do? Can you just change the weights? If you could, that would be magical, right? I'll change the 90 to 70 and the 10 to 30. Why can't I do that? What will happen is I go from a 10% debt ratio to 30% debt ratio. My cost of equity will go up. Why? Because, you know, if you use betas, the levered beta will go up. And my cost of debt will also go up because I have three times as much debt as I used to. The bank's not going to lend me money at the same rate. Both my cost of equity and the cost of debt will go up. So please don't change your debt ratios and the cost of capital without carrying through the effects on cost of equity and cost of debt. So I come up with, let's say, a cost of capital of 6.6%. Should I value the company using that cost of capital? It's a question, actually. The question I'm asking is, when I value a company as an investor, should I value it at the target debt ratio or at the actual debt ratio? If I valued at the target debt ratio, what's going to happen? Yeah. In a sense, if I valued at the target as a passive investor, do you see the danger I face? I'm going to use a 6.6% cost of capital, push up the value of the company. I'm going to buy the stock and then do what? Sit and wait and hope they change to the target. But if these guys are conservative, they never borrow more money, I'm going to be stuck with a 10% debt ratio essentially in perpetuity. So I cannot use the target automatically if I'm a passive investor. If I'm an activist investor or doing an acquisition, it's a different game. Do you see why? Because then I run the company, I can change the debt ratio. Be careful about just flipping around debt ratios as a passive investor, because in valuation, you don't run the firm. It's not your firm, you can't change things just because you don't like them. It is the way it is, and you've got to value it with that reality. Now let's talk about terminal value. Let's put behind us a choice we made already, but let's make sure we never bring it into the equation. If you're going to compute a terminal value for a firm, I'm going to give you three potential ways you could do it. And one of these should never be used, and I'd like you to scratch it off the choices right up. You can use a stable growth model, right? Growth 3% a year forever, 2% a year forever. You can use a multiple of EBITDA, revenue, or book value or something in the terminal year. Or you can do a liquidation value. Which of these is incompatible with an intrinsic valuation? B. Let's scratch it out. And again, be aware of it. It's something that's going to come at you. Be very clear about why you should never do it. Because if you do it, what have you done? You've done a Trojan horse DCF. We talked about this. We've slipped in a pricing, and that pricing is driving the valuation. So let's say you decide to go the stable growth route. Let's say that your after-tax earnings and cash flow in your terminal year are $120 million. The company is an all-equity-funded company with a 10% cost of equity, and there's no growth rate in this company. So basically, it's going to earn $120 million every year in perpetuity with a cost of capital of 10%. What's the terminal value? 120 million is your cash flow forever. Your cost of capital is 10%, your terminal value is $1.2 billion, right? So write that down. That's your base terminal value. What would happen if I told you this company would grow 2% a year forever? What's the terminal value going to be? Sounds like I can take the 120 divided by 0.10 minus 0.02, which will give me $1.5 billion, right? This is magic. This is how we push up values. What did I do wrong in the second calculation to push up the value to 1.5 billion? I left the reinvestment at zero. 120 million is my cash flow if I have no growth. Now that I've introduced a 2% growth rate, what do you need to know? What's my cost of capital? How much am I reinvesting? In fact, if I told you the cost of capital is 10%, I'm sorry, the return on capital is 10%. To invest 2%, to get a 2% growth rate, how much do you have to reinvest? 2 divided by 10 is 20%. 120 net of 20% is 96 million. Divide the 96 million by 0.08, and you'll get exactly what you got before, the $1.2 billion. Don't play with growth rates and terminal values. If the growth rate changes, carry it through to its logical next step and say, what will that mean in terms of reinvestment? Because if you don't ask that question, you've essentially just let the growth rate take over your terminal value. Now comes the loose end. Yes, sure. With option C, not necessarily, right? The question is, in option C, would you end up undervaluing the company? No, if it's a kind of business where liquidation value is greater than going concern value, what kinds of businesses would that be in? Distressed or bad businesses. In a bad business, how do you keep going? You keep putting money back into the business and making a 5% return on capital when you should be making a 10%. Why are you, I mean, this is insane, right? There's no reason for a company to exist once its reason for existence is gone. So this is actually, you could actually test out for the business, whether it's better to liquidate the business after 10 years or do your going concern. It's a higher of the two numbers that will drive your decision process. So this is actually a question coming right out of your second quiz that gave some of you nightmares. Let me reawaken some of these nightmares. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to assume that I've taken cash flows, discounted in the back at a cost of capital, and come up with a value of 100 million. So I've done the dirty work, and now I'm trying to mop up loose ends. So with each item that I list out, here's what I'd like you to tell me. Whether you're going to add this item, subtract this item, or ignore this item. Help me out in this. What's going to determine add, subtract, or ignore? If you've already valued this item, you don't want to add it on. That'll be double counting. But in this case, I want to get from that value to the value of the equity. Let's see with each item whether you can tell me what I should do. So you ready? We're at 100 million. Cash balance of 15 million. Add, subtract, or ignore. Tell me why. It's something we do all the time. Why do we do it? We started with after-tax operating income to get to free cash flow of the firm. You're saying, so what? Because the income from cash is not part of EBIT. We haven't valued it yet. That's why we add cash. It's not some automatic. That's why we don't add cash when we do a dividend discount model. Do you see why? Because what do I pay dividends out of? Net income, which comes from? Both interest income from cash and other income. We don't add cash to a dividend discount model, but we do add cash to a free cash flow of the firm valuation because we haven't valued it yet. So we're at 115. Somebody keep a running tab for me because we're going to get lost very quickly. So we've added the cash. Everybody comfortable with that? I have debt outstanding of 20 million. To get to equity value, add, subtract, or ignore? Subtract, because I want to get to equity value. So we're at 95 million, right? So I'll keep the running tab since none of you seems to be wanting to keep it. Right? So you've added the cash, subtracted out debt. Turns out that I have a 5% holding in another company. The book value of the holding is 5 million. The market value of equity in the entire company is 200 million. Add, subtract, or ignore. I hear about half adds and half subtracts. Maybe I should net it out and just ignore it. Eh? Again, what's the reasoning we use for cash? What's the question you need to ask? Have I counted this already, right? Have you counted this already? Why not? It's a minority holding in another company, and the income from that holding shows up below your operating income line. So that's why you have to add the 5%. But what are you going to add? The book value or 5% of 200 million, the market value? It should be 5% of 200 million, which is the market value. That's why when you value Yahoo, you have to add Alibaba and Yahoo Japan to your DCF valuation because these are minority holdings. So I'm going to add $10 million. So we're at $105 million. Last question. You see a minority interest on the same balance sheet of $10 million. First, which side of the balance sheet are you going to see minority interests on? Asset side or liability side? Liability side. And what does it capture? The portion of the company that you consolidated that doesn't belong to you, right? In book value terms. Unfortunately, that's all you have. Add, subtract, or ignore. See, this, I should give you quiz two again for the final exam. Because you have absolutely no idea where to go next, right? Go back to the test. When I value the company, I used EBIT. EBIT came from the income statement, which was consolidated. I acted like I owned 100% then, right? And I don't own it. So I need to subtract it out because I don't own 100%. So I subtract out the $10 million. I end up with $95 million. Add cash, subtract debt, add minority holdings, subtract minority interest. I've got a value for equity in the company. Would that value change if I told you that you were the target of a lawsuit where if you lose, you could have, you might have to pay $100? That's catastrophic, right? $100 million payout is the equal of the... First, let's take the easy part. Will that lower your value or increase your value now that I've given you this good news? It'll lower your value. And what would you need to estimate to figure out how much lower? The probability that you will lose the lawsuit. If it's 20%, 20% of $100 million is $20 million. You'll have to subtract it out to get the value of equity. So go back and review this page because it goes through the pieces. Yes?
The alternative value be negative or zero?
The alternative value for what?
If I lose the lawsuit and I pay $100 million?
I declare bankruptcy. It depends on whether I have limited liability, right? So if I'm a public company, obviously my value would be floored at zero. If I'm a private business, I could potentially be liable for the extra amount. But that's good thinking because then you'd value the equity under the 80% and value the equity under the 20%, which might give you a floor. That's, you know, the public company, it's probably better to put the floor at zero so you don't end up with a negative value for the equity. Right? You can't go negative with a public company because with limited liability, once you hit zero, you just walk away from the transaction. Okay?
What about debt? I mean, I still have to pay the debt.
No, not if you have limited liability. You pay whatever you can, right? So if you lose a lawsuit, here's what you're going to say. That guy is now a debtor, right? You now owe the person who won the lawsuit $100 million. That adds on to your debt. You now owe well above your value of your assets. You just turn it over to them. You go to the court, and the court will liquidate your assets, and they will get whatever they can out of it. They'll fight with each other as to who has prior claim. But you're done. You got hit zero. You can move on. And that's the essence of limited liability, is even though the debt is still out there, you can walk away from the transaction. Now to get from equity value to equity value per share. Let's say you value the equity in a firm at $200 million. There are 10 million shares outstanding. The value per share is $20 per share, right? Now let's suppose if I told you there were 2 million employee options outstanding with a strike price of $20 per share. What's going to happen to your value per share? If I let exercise value drive the way I think about valuation, what's going to happen to my value per share? The options are at the money. So if you use the treasury stock approach, here's what's going to happen. If these options get exercised, what's going to happen? You're going to get $40 million in cash coming in. So your numerator is going to go from 200 to 240 million. The denominator is going to go from 10 to 12. So you're going to say nothing's going to happen to my shares. But that's based on the presumption that your options are exercise value, that they're exercised today. Why is that wrong? Because you go to the CBO and try to buy options at the money options, nobody sells them to you for nothing, right? You got to pay a price. So what do we need to do? You need to take the 2 million options and value them as options. And because they're valued as options, they're going to have some value, $1, $2, $3, $5 per share, per option. Then what's the next step? Subtract out the options from the 200 million and then divide by the 20 million shares outstanding. So there are two ways of dealing with options. One is exercise value. That's what the treasury stock approach assumes. The other is to value them as options, subtract them from the value of equity, and divide by the actual number of shares outstanding. Last piece, and as I said, this is a page you saw way back in time. It's a valuation of Carborundum for an acquisition by Wasserstein Dutke for Chicago. And what do? They estimated cash flows based on net income. They start with net income. And as we go along, I'll show the clues. So they start with net income. They subtract the net capex, change in working capital, and also debt payments. So what kind of cash flow do they end up with? Free cash flow to equity. So if you have free cash flow to equity, the right discount rate is cost of equity or cost of capital? Cost of equity. Let's close the process. It's an acquisition. You've got an acquiring company's cost of equity and a target company's cost of equity. Which one should you use to discount the target company's cash flows? Target company's cost of equity. In which case, you'd be using a 16.5% cost of equity, not the 10% cost of capital that they actually used. So it's a very common mistake because you get so caught up in cash flows, you forget what kind of cash flow you're discounting. Next thing you know, you're discounting at the wrong discount rate. So that's the review. So let's now look at your numbers. Before I even dive into your numbers, I'm going to do the standard disclaimer, which is these numbers came from you. Okay? So if you see some absurd numbers, it's not my fault. Okay? So for better or worse, let's get the game going. First question I asked you is, what kind of cash flow do you use to value a company? And you have three choices. You can discount dividends, you can discount free cash flow to equity, you can discount free cash flow to the firm. There's a hands-down winner here. In 87% of the companies, I think 212 out of the company of the 230-something companies, is free cash flow to the firm. And I understand. You know why, what the advantage of free cash flow to the firm is? You can stay agnostic about the debt ratio till the very end, right? Because with free cash flow to equity, you're going to say, I think the debt ratio is fixed and it's not going to change. Free cash flow to the firm gives you that luxury. So how do you account for this 6% that use dividends? What does that tell you? There were 15 financial service companies valued in this class. There, that's it. 14 of the 15 were valued with the dividend discount model because it's desperation time, right? Let's face it. You tried estimating cash flows, but after your third try, you said, this is hopeless. I'm just going to assume that banks are managed by sensible people and that they're regulated by sensible regulatory authorities. It's a Faustian bargain we've made, but you can understand, right? So that's the dividend section. There's a small segment of free cash flow to equity for mostly stable companies where the debt ratio was pretty much settled, but mostly free cash flow to the firm. So before I show you the next page, because I actually had to change it after I put together this packet, you know, I never constrain people from valuing a company that somebody else is valuing. There were three companies in this class that were valued by 9 people each. And I want to show you some scary, scary output. Scary output in the sense, if you think that intrinsic value is some constant. And you'll see why I don't constrain people. These are the three companies that were valued by at least 9 people each. Lululemon, I don't know what it is about this company. Maybe you do a lot of yoga and you like their pants, or maybe you like their CEO who thought the pants were see-through, or whatever it is. This is a company that fascinates people every single year. So that's the first. There were 9 people who valued Lululemon. 5 of you asked me to buy the company. 4 of you told me to sell the company. Okay, that's fine. Okay. The second was Twitter. Again, 5 buys, 4 sells. And you can see the wide variation. The prices should be the same. But my guess is you got distracted sometime during Friday when you were putting this together, because it's supposed to be closed Friday, but they're all pretty close. But the differences will be in your DCF value and your recommendations. And 9 people value Tesla, 1 buy, 8 sells. Okay. Now, I'll tell you what I read in this. I am actually not surprised here, because what do we say about young companies like Twitter? It's driven by story, and depending on what your story is, you can get that wide band of values. That's what you're seeing here, right? So you're seeing the divergence. If 9 people had valued Coca-Cola, you would not have seen this divergence. It's the nature of young companies. So to me, it's not some sign of weakness. That's the reality of intrinsic valuation. And that's why when somebody says, why can't I just plug things into a model, let the model tell me what the value is, models can't reflect your story. Here's what you find overall. Your median company was undervalued by 6.73%. The average was much higher. You're saying, why? Because all you need is one outlier, 300% under. So you're about 6.7% undervalued. So basically, I'm taking the DCF value and dividing by the price. Okay. Now let's see what the most undervalued companies were in the class. So these were your findings on most undervalued companies. Take it again with a grain of salt. Those are the companies that came out as undervalued. There's the price, there's the DCF value, that's how much they were undervalued. So the most undervalued company in the class was Glencore. Is that yours?
Yeah.
I'll come back and ask you what I think is the defining question, which will tell me whether I should be buying Glencore, but I'll hold off on that. Okay. There's the model that you use, there's your DCF value. You're saying, why even listing the recommendation? Because sometimes you can find something undervalued and not feel confident enough to buy. In fact, there's one hold here on Kohl's, even though it's significantly undervalued. Okay. Which again is perfectly understandable. You've got to have that faith in your own valuation to make that final leap. And at least on paper, most of you say you have faith. That's the question I'm going to ask you. On paper, you had faith. Writing B-U-Y is actually just typing in three words or three letters. Let's see if it carries over into something more substantial. These were your most overvalued stocks. I'm sorry. Tesla. Yeah. Somebody should give some love to Tesla here. Tesla probably shows up 2 times. Amazon shows up, I think, 4 times. And I'll be quite honest. Amazon is an enigma wrapped in a mystery. It's a company that I find very difficult from an intrinsic value standpoint to even tell a story now to get to 650. So I'm not surprised that you're seeing these valuations reflected. So those are the most overvalued stocks. Now, of course, this will be my 31st year teaching this class, my 52nd semester teaching this class, and 52 semesters I've put together these lists. Now, I know these are intrinsic valuations. I've got to cut you some slack, because if I come back next 6 months from now and say, did it work? You're going to say, well, not a long enough time horizon. So what I've started doing is keeping track of the buy recommendations 5 years after. In other words, I go back to 2010, I can take the buy record and see what they're... So this is the track record across classes, basically. And you can get the updated values. Basically, the blue is the buy recommendations. The red is the S&P 500, and the green is the sell recommendations. So overall, the good news is, on average, buy recommendations do seem to do better than the market, and sell recommendations do tend to do worse. So I started digging through the numbers to see, because obviously every buy recommendation doesn't pay off and every sell recommendation doesn't drop. Here's what I saw. On average, you're right. You're more often right with small cap and emerging market companies than with large cap and heavily followed companies. Okay? This is just looking across time. And when you get those returns for a class, it's usually not because 51% of the buys did really well. It's because you had 5 or 6% of the buys do extraordinarily well. Like the 99 class, whoever picked Apple pulled up the entire portfolio. And that's, I think, something to remember when you look at your portfolios. Your portfolios, it's going to be 2 or 3 companies that create almost all of the oomph in your portfolios. You look across time. It's not going to be. I have 51 stocks. In a good year, 5 out of those 51 will pull my portfolio up, not 46 out of 51 or 35 out of 51. You're saying, so what? Those 4 or 5 stocks are the stocks I'm most tempted to get rid of earlier in the process. The reason so many investment philosophies fail is people buy into the philosophy intellectually, but they don't buy into it psychologically. I'll give you an example. Contrarian investing beats the market. It does. What does that mean? You're going to take the biggest losers from last year, and you're going to load up your portfolio with the biggest losers. That's what studies show. You can try it. Here's the problem, though. You load up with the 50 biggest losers from last year. For the next 6 months, you're going to feel a lot of pain on many of those losers. That's the nature of losers. They keep losing. And that's where the intellectual and the psychological will deviate. Your intellectual part of you say, oh, the studies show you should hold on. The psychological part of you says, just get rid of those five, hold on to the remaining 45. The five you get rid of will be the five you wish you'd held 5 years later. That's, I think, the lesson I get out of this. You've got to be very careful about pruning your portfolio once you have a philosophy. Because if you go pruning, you're going to prune those stocks you should not be pruning. And finally, those stocks which are undervalued in both the DCF and a relative valuation basis did much better than those which are undervalued only one. So that's why I'll put up the Excel spreadsheet with all of the valuations. You can sort them based on which companies were undervalued on both approaches, which were undervalued only one, because I think there is some information there. Then we got to relative valuation. Remember the four-step process we use for deconstructing multiples? We start by defining multiples. Now, Anna Kournikova's P/E ratio might be a little more complicated than Anna lets on. The numerator is a current price, but remember all the variations on the earnings. So don't take any multiple at face value. Don't assume that the other person is using the same definition you are. Don't adopt rules of thumb. You have the whole data in front of you. Look at the histogram. Go behind the multiple. Embedded in every multiple are the variables that drive that multiple. And only then should you use a multiple. And if you remember the metric we said, we went back to a discounted cash flow model. With equity valuation, we went back to a stable growth dividend discount model. With firm valuation to a firm valuation model. And with algebra, that's all it was, we figured out which variables to control for. Every multiple has a companion variable. Your job is to isolate what that variable is. So here's what you used as your multiples. EV to EBITDA, EV to sales. Hands down winners. What does that tell you? I told you 75% of you were valuing, you know, high growth companies. You kind of moved up the ranks again. No, wonder EV. PE 22%, price to book. 2%, I have no idea what you were even, the multiples that either you misspelled the word or this is some incredibly new multiple I've never seen before. So I'm going to wait and pass judgment on these. No. But it essentially captures a lot more enterprise value multiples. Again, going with the free cash flow of the firm, you can see why people move up to enterprise value. So then what I did was I compared your DCF value for the company with your own relative value. See what I'm doing? You gave me a DCF value and a relative value. I compared the two numbers. Here's the amazing statistic. When I divided your DCF value by your relative value, the median number was about 1. And that should cast us alive. People often say DCF valuation is always more conservative than relative value. In this class, that wasn't the case. Half the companies, the DCF value is higher. Half the companies, the relative value. In fact, on average, and the average is skewed up again, the DCF values were higher than the relative values. And here were the most undervalued stocks on a DCF basis. So these are based on comparing the price to the relative value. Most undervalued company on a relative value basis is Chesapeake. But notice what the recommendation on it is. It's a sell, because the discounted cash flow value gave you a different answer. Right? In this case, in fact, you can see that there are a couple of sells that pop up because your DCF value drives your decision. You had a relative value, you looked and said, I don't trust this number. So these are the most undervalued companies on a relative basis. And here are the most overvalued. The gain? Tesla is way on top. Most overvalued stocks, again, I'll let you scan the list, but you see Tesla show up a couple of times, Amazon a couple of times. No. Luckily for you, you didn't have too many companies with the option pricing model worked. There were 22 companies overall where you could use the option pricing model. And it made a difference. In those companies, the premium you got over your DCF value was about 129%. You did it because it pushed up your value, and that's it might be realistic in those companies. It's the highly levered, money-losing companies starting to behave like an option. It's driving the valuation. Last part of the class, we brought this all together, and we said we're going to go to the inside and change the way companies run. And if you think about it, there are four levers that drive value: cash flows, growth, risk, and when will you be a mature firm? Everything you do in value enhancement is focused around those numbers. This is what we did in the very last session, saying, is there something I can do to manage my assets more efficiently? Shows up in your cash flows. Can I create more value from growth? Shows up in the value of growth. Can I manage my risk better? Shows up in the cost of capital. And your competitive strategies show up in how long you have before you become a mature company. So traditional DCF model, you can actually value the company twice, once with the status quo and once with the optimal. And towards the end of the session, I talked about EVA and CFROI and all these acronyms that consulting firms have developed because they want to sell you on something special. What these approaches share in common, though, is they are much simpler, right? They're selling simplicity. DCF is complicated here. What's the EVA? Take a look at the CFROI. So I'm going to just give you a cautionary note on all of these measures. They're all measurement mechanisms. You know what I mean? They're more like thermometers than cures for a fever. And EVA tells you what you've done, what your temperature is. It won't solve your problems. And if I make decisions based on EVA or CFROI, or I tie compensation to them, I'm in a sense asking for trouble. And I'm going to use EVA to illustrate some of the problems that came about in the 1990s. So in the 1990s, Stern Stewart, the consulting firm that was selling EVA, managed to get companies to tie management compensation to whether EVA went up or down. So what did managers do? They did everything they could to increase the EVA. So I'm going to take you through some perverse actions you can take as a manager that will make EVA go up while making the value of the company go down. I'm not saying this is what you should do, but this is what will often happen. The first is what I call the growth trade-off. What is EVA? It is this year's operating income net of the cost of capital. So if you want a high EVA this year, you're going to push up the operating income or do everything you can to make your operating income go up. So if you're a technology firm or a pharmaceutical firm, given how we measure operating income, what are you going to start doing? You're going to cut out R&D, right? Because if you cut out R&D, what's going to happen? Your operating income is going to jump. Your EVA this year is going to be higher. You're saying, but I'm giving up future growth. Why do you not care? You're going to collect your bonus or compensation, and you're going to move on. That's a growth trade-off. If I reward you based on EVA increases, that's the first game you're going to play. The second is you're going to try to enter into riskier and riskier businesses because I'm just measuring excess returns. An excess return of 6% on a 20% cost of capital is worth less than an excess return of 4% on a 10% cost of capital. But you don't care because I'm giving you money on pure excess return. So we're going to see companies push towards more risk. And finally, they're going to do everything they can to keep the capital invested low. So if I don't count leases as part of debt, you're going to lease everything. You're never going to borrow money and buy an asset. So it's a growth game, the risk game, and the capital invested game. And companies played it like crazy through the 1990s. In fact, about 20 years ago, I was on a panel with, it was a value enhancement panel. And they had Tim Kohler from McKinsey. They had Raleigh Thomas from BCG, which was essentially a firm that used CFROI. They had Bennett Stewart from Stern Stewart. And they had me as master of ceremonies. Again, I hate that job, but I got it anyway. So each of them gets up and describes, and this is to a group of CEOs and CFOs. They're describing what they do. So first, Tim Kohler goes and he talks about how McKinsey approaches value enhancement. And he talks about McKinsey uses a full-fledged DCF model, and he goes through it, and he's very balanced. He says, this is what we do well, this is what we do badly, and he sits down. Raleigh Thomas gets up, and he describes CFROI, and he talks about the pluses and the minuses and what it does well, what it does badly, and then he sits down. Then Bennett Stewart stands up. Bennett Stewart can sell refrigerators to Eskimos. He doesn't know the first thing about finance, but he's a great salesperson. He gets up,
And he holds up an annual report for this is European CEOs and CFOs. He says, do you want to be like Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola uses EVA. It's like one of those logic classes in high school. And he sits down. And CEOs all applaud. Basically, he's saying, look, all you need to do to be like Coca-Cola is use EVA. I was steaming. Nothing you can do as a master ceremony, but I bided my time. About 2 years later, I was on a different panel in New York with Bennett Stewart, but this time I wasn't master of ceremonies. I could say whatever I wanted. So I came prepared. I knew exactly what his prop was, the Coca-Cola annual report. I came with my own prop. So he does his usual thing. Oh, do you want to be like Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola uses EVA. And then he sits down. It's my turn to talk. I don't even talk. I pull out a pair of new Michael Jordan shoes. I just, you know, the Nikes. I take my time putting them on. Then I pour myself a bowl of Wheaties. Remember the Michael with the Michael Jordan on the top? I pour the Wheaties. I take a few bites and I say, could somebody point me towards a basketball hoop? I'd like to slam dunk a ball. I'll have to tell you, my leaping abilities are such that the only basketball hoop I can slam dunk a ball on is a Fisher Price one. Hey? I used to actually keep it well after my kids had grown up. I'd keep it in the deck and I'd go slam dunk through it. So, you know, make me feel like LeBron James. Hey? The point I was making is I can wear all the Nikes I want and eat all the Wheaties I want. I'm not getting within 3 feet of a basketball hoop. It's not going to change my leaping ability. A company can use all the EVA and CFROI approaches it wants, but if it's a badly managed, badly run company, it remains a badly managed, badly run company. We cannot use measurement mechanisms as magic bullets. So use your own prop mechanism to remember this, because too many consulting firms sell magic bullets. So you've all got your valuation, and the reason I tried to push you is I think that's what tests your faith, because it's easy to say I hold, right? So that's why I keep pushing every semester to see if I can make everybody buy or sell. Because at this stage, I wouldn't be surprised if you got a valuation and your first reaction is, I am not sure yet. I'll caution you. You will never be sure. So if you wait to be sure to buy equities, you will never buy equities. So that's, again, a fight you have to have with yourself. I can't fight it for you. The second is, maybe after you valued one company, you decide that this is not as easy as you thought it was, and you become a believer in market efficiency, which is fine. It's a healthy recognition early on. You paid the cost of this class. File it away. Put your money in index funds. Don't try to value companies. You'll have a lot of time on your hands. Or third, you say, look, you know, law of large numbers, which is, and this is what I tell myself when I look at a company. I said, look, I don't have to be right on this company. All I have to do is be right on average. Okay? And that's, I think, what allows me to go and invest in a company, even though I feel uncertain, is I know I'm going to be wrong, but I'm okay as long as all I'm doing is being wrong, not being biased. That's why you can afford mistakes, but you can't afford bias in the process. So let's bring this all together. I took your buys, your sells, and your holds. Okay. There were, I think, 87 buys, 130 sells, and 25 holds. So basically, this actually looks at buys, sells, and holds over the last almost 15 years. And actually, there are some very interesting numbers here. If you look at buys, sells, and holds, in spring of 99, just before the dot-com boom bust, the sells outnumbered the buys, and then after the bust, they were the buys. But in fact, the last semester, spring of 2015, I look at the ratio of buys to sells, was the lowest buy-to-sell ratio of any class in the last 25 years. What I mean by that is, I think the ratio was 45%. 45% of the record, no, for every 100 sales, there were 45 buys. Your number is a little better. I think you're at 65%, which means that for every 100 sales, there are 65 buys in this class. Again, file that away, do what you want with it.
But this class, in spite of your DCFs giving you pretty good numbers, much more tilted in favor of sells than buys, reflecting the timing of when I asked you for the recommendation. See why that mattered? What does last week look like for the S&P 500? Really bad week, right? Whether you like it or not, that probably had a role in whether you said sell or buy. And that's, again, you can't fight that. That's the reality. You can't act like you live in a vacuum and make those decisions. So you got intrinsic valuation, you got relative valuation. Which one should you go with? Well, part of it depends on what you're trying to value, right? If you're trying to value an asset with which is sellable, which you have cash flows on, I mean, all those factors play in. If you don't have cash flows, you can't value an asset. So I can't ask you to value Bitcoin. Bitcoin has no cash flows. You can price it. So it depends on what you're valuing. It also depends on you. And that's what I want you to start thinking about, because I can't give you the answer. It depends on your time horizon. And don't be fooled into thinking that you should have a long time horizon. That's what you're told. No, it's your decision to make. If you're not comfortable with a long time horizon, be honest with yourself. Okay? Ask yourself why you're doing the valuation. Let's face it, for many of you, your jobs will require you to put a number, and you won't have much choice, and what beliefs you have about markets. So I'd like you to think about this, because it's a question I asked you in the very first session, intrinsic, relative, or options, or basically markets are efficient. Think about this, because again, you don't have to give me the answer, but this is what I'd like you to start thinking about. What do you believe about markets? Which of these approaches do you feel most comfortable using? Which leaves me with what I promised at the start of the class. I said, if you're a storyteller, I'd like you to have some discipline. And if you're a number cruncher, I'd like you to have an imagination. So those of you who started this class as storytellers, here's what I hope you got out of the class. First is a little more confidence in your capacity to work with numbers. It's a process. Don't expect overnight to become a master of numbers. Second, a little more discipline to your storytelling. So the next time you talk in a strategy class, I want a voice in the back of your head to keep piping up, say, where's the number? Where's the number? Where's the... Don't say it out loud. It's a strategy class. You could get shunned. But I would like you to... And third, I hope you don't get intimidated when people throw numbers at you. You have enough weapons, enough about this process that you should be able to stop a number cruncher from intimidating you. If you're a number cruncher, I hope you are a little more willing to put a story behind your numbers, a little more imagination in your number crunching, and maybe the next time you hear somebody tell you a story, you're going to cut them some slack and think about what are the numbers behind that story. So I'm going to leave you with a final page of suggestions, lessons, take them what they are. First, every time I hear, and this I've heard it in over 35 years of valuation, people say it's a new age, a new era in valuation, there are new rules. What I find over and over again is the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's the same fundamentals, cash flows, growth, and risk that have always driven value. Second, this is a process where there are lots of little details. What beta, what equity risk, what cost of debt? When in doubt, step back and look at the big picture. Don't waste your time on the small stuff. There's lots of small stuff that's going to distract you. Third, it's easy to give anecdotal evidence. Oh, this worked, therefore. Don't let anecdotal evidence drive what you do. And don't let people's experience intimidate you. People say, I've been doing this for 40 years. So what? Just because you've been doing the same stupid thing for 40 years doesn't mean it's a good thing. So don't assume that just because somebody's been doing it for a long time that they know what they're doing. Which leaves me with my two final pieces of advice, and they're a little subversive. First, remind yourself, don't take any of this stuff too seriously. Remind yourself, it's only money. You say, what else is there? Seek some spiritual counsel, a rabbi, a priest, whatever you need to. That's not my problem. It's only money. And I'm reminded at the end of probably 10 years ago, second year MBA comes up to me. She was a history major from Yale, who usually, if you're a history major from Yale, you take the strategic MBA route. You know the one that I'm talking about? You pick every class with the word strategic in its name. And you can really go through 2 years of this program without ever seeing a number. I'm not kidding. But she ended up in this class, which is not a strategic valuation class. But she turned out to be pretty good at it.
At the end of the class, she comes up to me and she says, I never thought this would happen, but I have a job as a sell-side equity research analyst. I said, congratulations. She said, I'm really scared. I said, what are you so scared about? She said, what if I make a mistake? I said, be glad you're not a brain surgeon. If you make a brain surgeon makes a mistake, somebody dies on the table, you make a mistake, what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody gets a little richer, somebody else gets a little poorer. As long as that somebody else getting poorer is not you, what the hell doesn't matter? Think like a Marxist. You move some wealth around, move on. Final piece of advice, I know we're running out of time. If you're ever given a choice between understanding everything there is to understand about valuation and being lucky, which one should you pick? Pick lucky. I hate to tell you this, but this is a business where the dominant paradigm is luck. That's why some people win and other people lose. It's not skill. It's not some timing. It's just pure luck. And I was reminded of this when my mother-in-law came to visit in early 2000. My mother-in-law became an avid investor in the 1990s, which to me should have been a sign that the market was topping off. I kind of missed that sign. She came to visit and she'd watch CNBC all day with a passion. She made it a spectator sport. Every time one of her stocks would go on the ticker, go Cisco, go. Look, it went up an eighth. She was convinced through the 90s she was the competitive advantage that Cisco had. And all day long, all she would talk about was in her portfolio, what was out of her portfolio, what she wished was in and what she wished was out. And I had to act like I was listening. That's what son-in-laws do. And then she let it slip that she owned Qualcomm, one of the great stocks of 99, up 600%. I was impressed. I said, Judy, why do you pick Qualcomm? I knew the minute I asked this question I shouldn't have because she told me. She said she picked Qualcomm because it owned MCI. And I said, that's not Qualcomm, that's WorldCom. And she says, Qualcomm, WorldCom, what's the difference? I said, you picked the wrong company. If you really wanted to pick the company that owned MCI, you'd have lost 40%. No? I was afraid to ask her after that why she owned Cisco, afraid the answer might be I really like their vegetable oil or Saturday Night Live. But after she left, I did try a strategy. I'd pick a stock in the news, pick one that rhymes with it. You know what? If I'd made a lot of money, forget about this intrinsic value stuff. I'd have been on the rhyming stock strategy. So I wish you a lot of luck, and I will see you in the final exam.
Still open.